Become involved in and answer the first part of the last question of the double barreled question. But nevertheless, the question at the back thinks that that's far too long to wait for a majority of class conscious socialists. What he wants is for what he considers to be a class conscious minority to seize state power and to use that state power to heighten the consciousness of the rest of the working class and to bring about eventually socialist understanding in the majority. It's the old Bolshevik one. I'd like to hear that dealt with.
Well, very briefly, I thought that having stressed several times that minority movements for the fundamental change we envisage is impossible, that the whole thing devolves upon the consciousness of the worldwide majority of the working class, the point about minority seizures of state power and using this to try and bring the majority into line for socialism, even this, as the thin end of the wedge, recognises that any minority who might seize power would be powerless to do anything about fundamentally changing society, about stripping the capitalist class and ushering in a classless communal way of life based upon production for use and free access, until a majority were in favour of such a change. But of course we would reject this concept that any such minority could first seize power and then set about trying to disseminate socialist ideas and bring the majority into this position of socialist understanding, because what they would be saddled with right from the off would, by virtue of being in control of the state machine, they would either have to become the handmaidens and caretakers, the administrators of the day-to-day affairs of running capitalism. They would have to attend to the affairs of state. They would have to look at imports and exports and organising production and keeping the wheels of industry turning as profitably as they can. And they would willy-nilly, regardless of where they started out from or how much they may have thought themselves to be socialists to start with, from the moment they take power in a situation where the vast majority of people are not ready for socialism, all they can do is administer capitalism, and this is what the working class would be left with. And they would do what the Bolsheviks or any others in such a situation have done and would try to do. They would have, if they hung on to power, then they would have to seek to justify their position. They would have to lie and trick and scheme by sticking and misapplying socialist labels to the hotchpotch police state of capitalism that they would be administering, and try to delude workers that the changes would be piecemeal and in the sweet by and by the leap forward into communism would come just around some other corner, if not this year, next year, sometime and never. So they would become, in effect, the agents of capitalism and the custodians of its private property relationships and the strong arm of its the manipulators of its coercive state machine. But no minority in such a situation could fundamentally change society. They could not be an instrument for the attainment of socialism. I repeat, only a world democratic working class majority consciously using the vote for the one purpose of gaining political power to strip the capitalist class, so that the legally instituted apparatus of all the private property relationships in capitalist society can be brought to an end by making the means of production, all the apparatus for the production and distribution of wealth throughout the world, the communal property of all mankind. No minority can do this. Only a working class majority, using a party like the Socialist Party of Great Britain in this country and counterparts like it throughout the world, for this one avowed aim and purpose, is capable of achieving that kind of change.
Yeah.
Usually change once they are applied. I think throughout the whole of history, it doesn't matter whether you have a political party or any other organizations. Once you have principles and you apply them, you could have some compromise. You change your principles. If you want an omelette, you've got to break the eggs. Something must change. And the same applies to religion. If you want to keep a particular dogma, even the resurrection of Christ, keep it going as a dogma. To make sure it doesn't apply in practice. Keep it apart from reality. It's always theory. Once the theory is applied, you've got to change it. You've got to have a compromise. This, I think, you don't want to do.
You see, it's very nice to speak with these metaphors about to make an omelette.
you've got to break eggs. It's a pretty innocent thing. In fact, it's the thing we all do. The omelette eaters amongst us anyway. But what does it mean in real terms? That's the sort of terminology of people like Trotsky and Lenin and Stalin and so on. In other words, we've got to imprison people. We've got to restrict people speaking about new ideas. We've got to restrict people writing and thinking and talking about their ideas. That's what's called breaking a few eggs. If you've got to imprison people, if you've got to shoot them, go and murder them, well, that's breaking a few eggs to make this beautiful omelette that we're going to eat soon. The religious people used to make it pie in the sky. A friend here is making it some sort of Bolshevik omelette we're going to get once we get out of prison. That was for your own good. You've been put in prison. Yes, I know it's hard. And we know we've got these principles that inside a socialist society we'll have common access to all the wealth it produced. But meanwhile, because of these difficult times or because of outside pressures or some other reason, we've got to have this horrible police state. Now, Stalin, in a book called Economic Problems of Socialism, dealt with this. Some of his critics, very brave men, produced this little pamphlet where they asked them simple questions. According to Marx, there'll be no law of value inside socialism. There'll be no commodity production. How do you explain it? And of course he, or one of his hired professors, set about explaining it. How you had socialism and at the same time you had a dictatorship. How you had socialism and at the same time you had profits. How you had socialism and at the same time you had rent. How you had socialism and at the same time you had rich and poor. You had privileged and people without privilege. He had to explain this, or his hacks had to explain it for him. Now, that is what's meant by breaking a few eggs. Now, principles, we've not got any holy thing. You mentioned religion. We've not got a holy, it's not a principle. We're not this South Place ethical society. We're not that. Get rid of that moral viewpoint. The Socialist Party of Great Britain is amoral. We've not got a morality about these things. What we're talking about is a practical alternative to the world that we live in. And our principles are not some holy grail. They're examined by every member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain and by all their critics. And they're argued about. And they'll be rejected if they don't work. So rather than say to us, here's this beautiful set of principles you've got that you've had since 1904. They've been carrying about in this beautiful archaic language, like the Ark of God around with you through all your tribulations. We don't revere it and respect it and bow down to it. We examine it. It happens to be, as far as we're concerned, we may be very wrong. We may be wrong. It's up to you to prove it. As far as we're concerned, these principles are the only ones that work. That's why we endorse them. They work. Karl Marx and Engels, whose viewpoints in crisis said, they were scientists. They said that history has proved us and all who thought like us wrong. And we'll have to change our ideas in this respect. That's a scientific approach. If any development of capitalism occurs, in which we look at some of those principles of ours, and say, well, they don't work anymore, we'll have to change them. Not because they're this art of God, this holy grail, but because they are the workable tools that we use to try and speed up the change from capitalism to socialism. Principles, what do principles mean? Essential expediencies. That's what they mean. Principles, things that you don't change with every wave of a political climate, with every trend, with everything that see, we've been told since 1904, these principles are beautiful, but meanwhile we'll have to beat the Boche, or the Hun, hurl back the Hun. Socialism after we get rid of them. Socialism's okay, but what about Spain? What about this dictatorship? Socialism's okay, but what about this, and what about that, what about this? Join us, ban the submarine, ban the dum-dum bullets, ban the bow and arrow. Do this, do that, do this. Your principles are beautiful, but leave them and get on with the practical world. Well, all those pragmatic, and the word's used completely wrong, but I'll use it wrongly like they use it, all those pragmatic, practical people, where are they? There's a big list to the Socialist Party, and with a certain amount of glee, ticks off. That's them finished. We've had a great time at this, you know. We've seen the SDF off. You can just imagine some old sage of the party sitting with another old sage and going, I told you so. Sometimes, of course, we're a wee bit too optimistic. You know, sometimes we thought, well, the ILP can't last any longer. But Christ, they carried on a hell of a long time. The SDF, the British, well, you name them, the SLP, the whole lot of them. We're all going to get it just that wee bit quicker than us. And we're going to leave their principles behind in order to get support of people who didn't understand. Well, I know it makes us like holy rollers. I know it makes us beautiful and pristine, pure, virginal. We love it. As a matter of fact, it's only time, comrades, that I've been called a virgin. I'm a political virgin. I hold to these political viewpoints that have been proved correct. These principles. And I've never dropped my clause fours yet.
We've been told for a long time that socialism will come when a majority of workers will understand and want it. Well, judging by the last 30 years, for instance, I remember the time when the SPGB could pack out a theatre in Israel Road. Judging by that standard, it seems that far from an increasing number of people want understanding and wanting socialism, if anything, the number has diminished. Now, could either of the speakers give us some idea how they propose to get a majority of the workers to understand wanting socialism?
Makes the pessimistic sounding observation that to go back no further than 30 years, we've been insistently saying that only when a majority of people want socialism, and yet he can go back these 30 years when the party used to fill the Metropolitan Theatre and hold mammoth meetings here, there and everywhere, and if anything, there seems to be less enthusiasm for socialism now in 1976 than there was these 30 years ago. Now, there's an inherent contradiction in that pessimistic observation. And that contradiction is this, that no matter at what time in the future, be it 1,000 years hence, are you that pessimistic? Be it 100 years hence, or 50 years hence, or 20 years hence, at whatever time in the future the working class wake up and pursue their own interest in the establishment of socialism, it damned well must be 37 years nearer now than it was in 1946, and even you can't juggle maths to add it up any differently than that. Now, so far as the modification of people's ideas are concerned, I don't know what you've been doing for 30 years, old chum, but the members of this party have been working for socialism, stressing, straining every sinew to try and maximise their effort to spread that understanding of socialist ideas. I don't know what contribution you've been making towards that, or whether you're one of these self-appointed cynics who sit on the fence and every 30 years get down and sort of loftily wonder at what we're doing and how much progress we've made towards socialism. Let's put a little challenge to you. If the unspoken assumption of your question is that socialism is desirable and the urgent answer to the major social questions which curse our lives every waking hour under capitalism and every hour we're asleep as well, then if this is the unspoken inference in your question, then it behoves you as much as us to do something about it. Now, 30 years ago, my friend, not only did the Socialist Party of Great Britain fill halls, and there's not much wrong with this excellent audience here this evening either, but we've been filling halls since and holding very successful meetings throughout the country, every Sunday in Hyde Park, and our comrades in Glasgow firing on all cylinders and so on. But the Labour Party used to fill halls in those halcyon post-war days as well. And tell me the hall that you've been to where the Labour Party has spoken to a packed audience recently. You see, what has happened in the interim period is that you had 6 post-war years of the Labour Party, aided and abetted by the criminal left wing, the Scumminist Party and the Trotsky fraternity and the rest, urging the workers to vote Labour. And after 6 years of Labour-administered capitalism, with their panacea of nationalisation gone sour, and all their other doctrine of capitalism falling flat on its face, and the working class in disillusion and frustration went into the doldrums, and then you had 30 years of the Tories. So we've had to work within this kind of political aftermath of apathy left by the Labour Party saying for a generation, you don't have to worry about the SPGB and working class understanding. Elect a strong Labour government, says the Communist Party. Elect a strong Labour government, says the Trotsky left. Vote Labour, say the old guard and the left guard inside the Labour Party itself, and we will tax the rich out of existence. Nationalisation will be a stepping stone to radical change. We'll solve the housing problem. We'll get rid of poverty. We'll end by piecemeal reforms all the major social scourges and problems of capitalism. And it has been this failure to modify capitalism in the way that they have suggested which has created the suspicion of politics and the taint which hangs around argument about socialism today. When you knock at a worker's door today, if his father voted Labour 30 years ago, here's the kind of worker who is apt to say these days, bloody politicians, you're all the same once you get there, there's nothing to choose between any of you, and he slams his door by way of throwing the socialist baby out with the Labour Party's bathwater. This is the kind of situation that we have to struggle in. But nevertheless, even within this kind of situation, there is modification, because if 30 years ago, in the post-war years, an enthusiastic, politically misguided working class, on a great upsurge of expectation, voted for the Labour Party, they were politically pregnant, so to speak, and the Labour Party, Labour government was the stillborn brat that they've been saddled with ever since. If in those days the working class were politically misguided to the extent that they voted for their class enemies with their delusions in the form of the Labour Party, they are no longer so keen and enthusiastic to accord them support today. And all of the myths and the panaceas which the Labour Party peddled in those days are now universally held with, treated with contempt so far as the overwhelming majority of members of the working class are concerned. Today, they don't enthusiastically vote for the Labour Party because they think nationalisation or more state capitalism is going to solve any working class problem. They vote for the Labour Party overwhelmingly with the negative assumption that at least they're better than the Tories. And of course, there are many disaffected Labour Party supporters who vote for the Tories because they've gone the other way. They think they can't be any bloody worse than the Labour Party. It's a question, as we said, we were saying 30 years ago, it's Tweedledum and Tweedledee, there's nothing to choose between them. And that 30 years of history has modified the working class by learning this bitter lesson they've experienced, which they're still struggling to learn in many cases. But it's vindicated our position. And so far as we're concerned, it's an ongoing process. Time hasn't stopped here. The reckoning remains to come. The working class have still to take up the challenge of socialism and get to grips with their problems, and they won't succeed in doing this until they reject all these spurious friends of the working class, these Labour Party agents of capitalism supported by the CP and the left. Only upon this basis of their clear thinking and their embracing of socialist ideas is there any solution to be found. So it's no use you're talking about what modifications. Yes, there have been modifications. Look at the turn of the century. The last century is politically regarded as a liberal century. But of course, the Labour Party historically replaced the Liberal Party, which became universally discredited. If you were around in the heyday of the Liberal Party, you, with your great pessimism, would have thought that there would have been an eternity of liberal-run capitalism. But the working class didn't tolerate them for very long before they were discredited and discarded, and the Labour Party is now going through that phase. We would say that the prevailing situation with the remaining persistent social evils of capitalism still as pressing as ever, that the ground for socialist ideas was never more fertile, and our case stands as sound now as it always has.
To conclude this evening's meeting shortly after 9:30, that's about 10 minutes time. So we're going to take one more question, and then I'm going to ask Comrade Baldwin just to wind up on the subject of tonight's talk. Could we have one more question at all? A question, please. Yes, you, Comrade. A question, please.
Thank you, Comrade Chairman. We have in our midst, as some of you may be aware, two members of the Workers' Institute of Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong thought. And I've been reading some of their literature, which they kindly gave me copies of. I understand that these fellow members of the working class, I cannot call them comrades, support the PLO, a very well-known terrorist organization. They are therefore not revolutionaries, but reactionaries. They also make some very peculiar statements, say, speaking here of Africa, and they write that the Ghanaian working people denounce the inhuman policy of apartheid, racism, colonialism, and imperialism. Have they never heard of capitalism? Have they never heard of that as the root cause of imperialism, etc., etc.? Because that's the very basis. We oppose not a political system, we oppose an economic system.
Mr. Chairman, you might allow me to answer that. In your talk,
you haven't talked as the last person asking a question should ask it of you. That was not my intention. I wanted a question. You must take it up with her individually. This is not our intention up here. I want one question for the speakers to deal with, and as I say, I'm then going to invite Comrade Baldwin to wind up. If there's not a question, Comrade Baldwin will wind up now. I have one here. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Have we proposed to educate the working class in your practical terms?
The question is, how do we propose to educate the working class to understand socialism? Is that your point?
Now,
yes.
Practical terms.
Because you put yourself forward to be very practical, but as yet I haven't heard anything that sounds practical.
Yeah. Fair enough. But, well, the point is, like a friend over here, you know, my comrade was answering, this chap here, he's disappointed with the fact, I don't know anything about him, but what I've heard, he's disappointed by the fact that, in his knowledge, the 30 years of the Socialist Party of Great Britain's activity, and let's face it, we've not got socialism. And he's pretty disappointed about that. Well, you're not unique. I'm desperately disappointed myself. I mean, I don't get the idea, as Comrade Baldwin has said, that I've strained every sinew like a socialist superman. Comrade Baldwin does that. I don't strain my sinews for socialism. But within the ability of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, we have been doing, as far as we know, the only thing that can be done about socialism. What we've been doing is we've talked to people about it, we've written about it, we've debated about it, and at every opportunity, we've tried to get our ideas across and try to show that our ideas tie up with the real world that you live in. That the Daily Express, or the Daily Mirror, or the Conservative Party, or the Preacher, or the pundit on the television box, that all the orthodox ideas just don't work. That they can't explain the world they live in, and they can't deal with the real problem. Namely, that this society cannot solve the problems. It cannot satisfy the needs of the population. That's why you've got a problem, because you can't satisfy your needs. You want to live a life of harmony. You want to live a life where you're well-fed and secure. You want to live a life where you can be a human being with a bit of integrity. You want to be a human being that's free of the prospect of war or crime. You want to be a human being that lives in decent surroundings. You want to be a human being that lives a human life. But you find the practical realities are that you can't do that. Because you live inside, and you were born inside, it's not your fault. You were born inside a society that denies you satisfying these needs. And of course this has happened throughout history. And when men get to a point where we can't deal with it, they look for solutions. Now, we say that ours is a practical solution. And as far as we know, the only way to get socialism is to have a majority of socialists. And as far as we're aware, there's only two agencies working towards bringing about a majority of socialism, or socialists. That is, the efforts, puny though they may be, in relation to the big power parties, the efforts of the World Socialist Movement, which people are always wanting us to compromise, and capitalism, the social system we live in, itself, forcing people to look for an alternative, forcing people to say these orthodox ideas don't work. I mean, all we want here, well, it's not a Billy Graham campaign, we all step forward and sing the red flag. All we're asking you to do is to question your view of the world, to have a look, and as critical a look as possible, this alternative view of the world you live in, of the World Socialist Movement. Now, I'm disappointed about the progress of socialism. As far as I know, the only way to change a man's ideas, or a woman's ideas, is to speak to them. That's the only thing you can do. It's true, it's much more romantic. And I use that word, romance, in inverted commas. To rob a bank. To kidnap somebody and get food parcels from a millionaire. Your certainty for a big media cover there. The certainty for the News of the World or the New York Herald Tribune writing profiles on you as a terrorist. To hijack an aeroplane. Or if you're a real hero, to put a bomb and amongst workers going to their work or in a hut where the building workers are. You're a real hero then. You've killed people. You've done something practical. Now let us assume that all of us went out here and decided they were so fed up with capitalism we're going to do some of the things that have been proposed here. That is, we get guns and shoot people. That changes their mind, doesn't it? They stop thinking. And if you've got enough guns and there's enough of you, you could perhaps kill everybody that doesn't agree with you. You couldn't get socialism that way. No matter how romantic and apparently revolutionary it is, it's just keeping the system going. As a matter of fact, what you'll do as a byproduct of that is you'll make capitalism even more awful. The police will be given more and more powers. I mean, the anarchists in Spain, instead of liberating people by acts of terrorism, they've made it that the state machine can turn around and say, look, this police force is fighting your own interests. It's not our interest to round up people that are putting out leaflets because they might bomb you next week. In other words, it's a good thing for a state machine to have terrorists. They're protect. They become, this orthodox viewpoint becomes law and order, saving you from this abyss of anarchy, terrorism, and all the rest of it. I am not satisfied with the efforts of the Socialist Party of Great Britain to get its ideas across. But no matter what ideas I may think of as an individual member about the party and where it could have done better here or it should have done that and so on, every member of the party does this. Not just the critics of the party do this. No matter how much I think about it, one thing's sure and certain, as far as I can see, until I hear an alternative idea. The only way to get socialism is to have a majority of socialists. And the only way to get a majority of socialists is for those very small group of men and women who understand socialism, who understand the basic principles and who are organised to get socialism, to do this thing. Not as it says up here, quoting Shakespeare, to thine own self be true. That's a real bourgeois capitalist viewpoint. But this one, more important, to the principles of your class be true. And if anything's happened in recent history since this in this century, there's one thing. The Socialist Party of Great Britain may have not made tremendous progress. It's certainly by no accounts a mass party. But one thing about it, it's got a wonderful record of espousing the case for international socialism. And it's the only organised group in this country that does that. And in a negative fashion, we're bloody proud of that.
Thank you. I don't have a great deal to say, but you, before coming to this meeting this evening, I thought it might be a useful thing to do to go along to a reference library and see how the capitalist class are getting on. That is, I thought at a meeting like this there are sure to be some well-versed opponents of the Socialist Party of Great Britain and who might get up and defend capitalism and its record, and we'd have to be prepared. So some of the things I came across, some old material, some fairly new, about the concentration of wealth in the hands of a minority. The Labour Party, in their publication, their first political manifesto as such, Labour and the New Social Order of 1918, had it that 10% of the adult population of this country owned 90% of the wealth. And you can trace a succession of such figures from about the turn of the century onwards to after a succession of Labour governments, in particular 1945 to 51, the six wasted years of Labour-run capitalism that I referred to earlier. Judith Hart, a Labourite, who was then the Under-Secretary of State for Scotland, in The Guardian in 1965, May 1965, said that 50% of the wealth of Great Britain is still in the hands of 1% of the population. There's a succession of inland revenue figures which bear out something of the same kind of proportions. And then, somewhat more up to date, in the reference library in Brixton, near where I live, they have a royal commission that's been deliberating earnestly at some great depth and is in the process of publishing its findings on wealth ownership and income distribution. And after all of their reforms, after all the years of the welfare state and the taxation of the rich, and all of the alleged modifications of capitalism and the improvement of the lot of the working class, it still transpires that the top 20% of the adult population own seven times as much as the bottom 20%. So upon that basis, the piecemeal adjustment of capitalism, they've achieved precisely nothing in the fact that the means of wealth production and the great ownership of wealth still concentrates in the hands of a few. We read in the press just recently on the death of Howard Hughes. He left about £1,000 million or dollars, I don't know which. Paul Getty has about £300 million. The Sunday Telegraph, I'm throwing some of this stuff in. It was crowded out in the 20 minutes, which rather cramped some of the stuff that was prepared for. The Sunday Telegraph for August 17th, 69, published a list of 15 millionaires, from Lord Cowdery with 59 millions to Garfield Weston with 200 millions, and Isaac Wolfson with a paltry 35 millions. Now, when you look at these figures after a generation of the welfare state, and you look at poor Harold Wilson, who's got a contract, so we're told, for some £300,000 for the second volume of his memoirs. He hasn't done so well out of capitalism after all, has he? Only £300,000. He only got $250,000 for the first volume and £300,000 for this. I should have thought inflation might have marginally improved his whack. But perhaps, you know, having read the first volume and they know what's coming, perhaps they don't think it's worth the candle anyway. But at least Harold Wilson, on your backs, doubtless en route to the final resting place of all good Labour leaders in the House of Lords, he's made £300,000, half a million out of it, plus whatever perks and fiddles there might have been, apart from the 20-odd thousand a year, as Prime Minister. But having voted Labour on the advice of the left, he and his ilk have left you precisely where they found you, in the middle of one of capitalism's classical crises, and nowhere to turn for any solutions, since all of their bogus answers have been explored and found to be entirely futile. Now, in conclusion, First, may I just say this, that if perhaps it might be felt by some of the questioners that I, in reply, may have leaned a little heavily on them or sounded unduly harsh, this is just my way of speaking and not my intention. Try and retain the content of what has been said and not necessarily the style or however you may have thought about that. The thing is that there's no personal hostility here on an individual basis. What we're opposed to are your obsolete ideas, all of the fallacies and foolhardy notions you've got in your head by way of continuing to support the ugly existence of capitalism. We welcome your questions and thank you for coming along and thank you for the interest you've shown. And in conclusion, the outcome and the final point about tonight's meeting is that it is not now for the Socialist Party of Great Britain until conference rally next year to carry the Olympic torch for socialism, so to speak. But our propaganda, obviously the whole point that's been borne out again and again throughout tonight's meeting, is that it is a challenge to you, non-party members, the ordinary members of the working class, in this hall and outside, for you to interest your friends and your contacts, your fellow workers, where and wherever you might meet them, and for you to take up the challenge of joining with us, because, as we said again and again, the responsibility for the attainment of socialism rests with you. A future society and the ending of the misery of capitalism is not something which rests entirely with the Socialist Party of Great Britain. We haven't a monopoly. We haven't cornered, as it were, the market on socialist ideas, only in the sense that as an organisation we're the sole organised expression of them. But in order for this to reach its triumphant conclusion, you've got to latch onto it. You've got to consciously pursue your own class interests and work with us and join with us to establish socialism. Thank you again, and we'll leave you.